Ambassador Kabak-Jolan, all present. My name is John Burroughs. I'm the Executive Director of the Lawyers Committee on Nuclear Policy, the UN Office of the International Association of Lawyers Against Nuclear Arms. I was moved by the presentations that preceded me, especially that of Mr. Sumitero, but I am now going to start a two-part presentation on key issues currently facing the non-proliferation disarmament regime. Perhaps you'll find some of it to be dry, but I think it's important. I hope you can bear with me. I'll start with U.S.-Russian reductions and beyond. The New START agreement, signed April 8, 2010 by Presidents Medvedev and Obama, will not fundamentally alter the nuclear balance of terror between the United States and Russia. The 2002 Strategic Offensive Reductions Treaty set a ceiling of 2,200 strategic deployed warheads. 7 years after entry into force, New START would lower the ceiling to about 1,500 warheads deployed on land and submarine-based missiles, plus up to several hundred bombs assigned to heavy bombers. This would not qualitatively change the relationship. The main virtue of the new agreement is that it will continue the process of reduction and ensure continued fulfillment of the verification and monitoring functions once met by START. One encouraging feature is that inspectors will verify the numbers of warheads deployed on missiles. In contrast, under START, warheads were ascribed to permitted delivery systems. The stakes and the obstacles would be much higher with respect to a subsequent agreement the Obama administration has indicated it would seek. Such an agreement following the START replacement could further reduce strategic warheads, reduce non-strategic warheads, and provide, for the first time, for verification of the dismantlement of withdrawn warheads. The result would be verified limits on the entire nuclear arsenals, not just deployed strategic warheads of both sides. Provisions should be made for international monitoring as well to afford accountability. Obstacles arise in part from the fact that Russia attaches great importance to its nuclear forces, including its non-strategic weapons, in view of its degraded security and military posture. And Russia will be reluctant to pursue deep strategic reductions while the United States engages in research and development regarding strategic anti-missile systems, makes advances in non-nuclear strategic strike systems, and holds open the option of deploying space-based strike and interceptor systems. On the U.S. side, there will be opposition from influential elements to limitations on all three types of non-nuclear strategic systems. Tensions between the two countries over anti-missile systems are ongoing. And regarding non-nuclear strategic strike systems, the Obama administration has proposed about $440 million in 2011 spending on long-range strike and prompt global strike, and spending on related work is scattered throughout the budget. There likely would also be significant resistance within the U.S. government to further reductions of strategic nuclear arms per se. From the standpoint of civil society, it would be unacceptable for Russia to put nuclear disarmament on hold pending improvement of its overall security posture. But it is also crucial for the United States to reassure Russia, indeed as well as word, that nuclear disarmament is part of the project of building common security. The two countries should establish a process for continuous arms reduction talks, CART, bringing in other states that possess nuclear arsenals. Reductions could proceed in parallel with preparations, deliberations, and negotiations for a nuclear weapons convention. A final but important observation regarding reductions. Negotiations can be derailed by domestic or international developments. It remains the case that the United States and Russia and other states with nuclear weapons can and should undertake unilateral reductions which can be politically coordinated. Such initiatives both reduce tension and invite reciprocation. Now I want to address modernization and investment. In and of themselves, reductions do not suffice to create a path to elimination. A key step toward multilateral nuclear disarmament is for all nuclear weapon states, including those outside the NPT, to cease all research, development, modernization, and production of nuclear weapons. Ending modernization and investment is mandated by the Article 6 obligation to negotiate cessation of the nuclear arms race at an early date, the principle of irreversibility agreed in 2000, and the principle of good faith. As Judge Mohammed Bajawi, former president of the International Court of Justice, has explained, good faith requires states to, quote, respect the integrity of the NPT and to refrain from acts incompatible with its object and purpose. Good faith also prescribes, quote, every initiative, the effect of which would be to render impossible the conclusion of the contemplated disarmament treaty. And by that, he means the Nuclear Weapons Convention. Yet, research and development is taking place in all states possessing nuclear weapons for purposes of replacing existing systems, increasing reliability, and in some cases, enhancing military capabilities. The horizon for planning is measured in decades. For details, please see the written text of this presentation. Trading some arms control agreements or arsenal reductions for modernized nuclear forces and modernized or new research and production facilities capable of building the nuclear threat anew is not disarmament. If the danger of nuclear war is to be eliminated, ceasing to plan and build for an eternal nuclear threat must come early, not late in the process. Now I want to say something about transparency and reporting. At NPT review meetings, nuclear weapon states have provided general statements regarding, for example, reductions of deployed weapons. And some have also declared their arsenal size and fissile material holdings. However, there is nothing even resembling an authoritative accounting of warhead and fissile material stockpiles, nuclear weapons delivery systems, and spending on nuclear forces. Non-governmental researchers make valiant efforts to fill the gap, but their assessments are for the most part estimates based only partly on official information. The need for accounting is obvious. It would provide baselines for evaluating progress in disarmament and enable the identification of objective benchmarks. In his 24 October 2008 five-point proposal for disarmament, Secretary General Ban Ki-moon called for expanded reporting, observing, quote, that the lack of an authoritative estimate of the total number of nuclear weapons testifies as to the need for greater transparency, close quote. States should seek a commitment to establishment of a comprehensive UN-based accounting system. Next, I'll talk about operational status of nuclear forces.
In recent years, Chile, Malaysia, New Zealand, Nigeria, Sweden, and Switzerland have sponsored the General Assembly resolution Operational Readiness of Nuclear Weapons Systems. Other resolutions have addressed the issue as well. Last year, a very important report, Reframing Nuclear D-Alert, was released by the Swiss and New Zealand governments and the East-West Institute. It examines how to lower the state of operational readiness of U.S. and Russian nuclear arsenals. There is no doubt that very high states of operational readiness still exist almost two decades after the Cold War supposedly ended. The U.S. and Russia continue each to maintain about 1,000 nuclear warheads in a status such that some can be launched within 2 minutes, others within 10 minutes. Both President Obama and President Medvedev are at all times shadowed by someone with a briefcase from which either president can, in theory anyway, order a nuclear strike. The problem with having a system primed for such quick response is not so much that rogue commanders might fire one or two shots, or that computer error or equipment malfunction might result in launches, though that has nearly taken place at least twice that we know of. With response time so tight, presidents and senior military may have minutes or less to make decisions of utterly apocalyptic significance involving hundreds of warheads. If those decisions turn out to be based on honestly believed but completely false data, it is too late to recall the missiles and not possible to abort their missions. Decision-making under such tight time constraints and in such panic cannot ever be rational. The risks inherent in this posture are simply unacceptable. This is especially so in the light of recent peer-reviewed research, which predicts that less than 1% of the currently deployed and operational nuclear arsenals, if detonated in urban areas, would cause catastrophic damage to the global climate and environment. A, quote, regional nuclear war between India and Pakistan, for example, would loft millions of tons of smoke above cloud level and rapidly produce ice age weather conditions on Earth, leading to massive nuclear famine, which could cause up to 1 billion people to die of starvation. De-alerting should be pursued within or in connection with U.S.-Russian nuclear arms reduction negotiations, and also should be a topic for wider consideration by states with nuclear arsenals. Care should be taken in implementing de-alerting measures to guard against worsening crisis stability problems. Urgent work is needed to reduce the risks of accidental or mistaken launch, which is feasible short of more ambitious steps like demating warheads from missiles. The use of the main arsenals of the US and Russia would probably bring about the end of what we call civilization and possibly of our species. It is time to take the apocalypse off the agenda. It has been there too long. Thank you.